This is NBC Nightly News, Monday, May 20th, with John Chancellor and David Brinkley's Journal.
John Chancellor is off tonight. I'm Edwin Newman. The special Watergate prosecutor, Leon Jaworski, charged tonight that President Nixon is making a farce of the special prosecutor's office by not complying with subpoenas in spite of public pledges of cooperation. Jaworski accused President Nixon of going back on his promise not to interfere with investigation of the Watergate scandals and prosecutions resulting from them. Jaworski said all of this in a letter to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Carl Stern has the story.
In the six-page letter, Jaworski said the president's lawyers now describe the tapes issue as an intra-executive dispute, with the president having the final word on whom to prosecute and with what evidence. Said Jaworski, the president is challenging my right to bring an action against him to obtain evidence, or differently stated, he contends that I cannot take him to court. Jaworski complained that the president is trying to change the rules, the independence that was guaranteed the prosecutor when he came on board. The president's new strategy surfaced last week at the closed-door argument on Jaworski's subpoena for more White House tapes. In opposing Jaworski, the president's lawyers argued, in essence, that yes, the president would stick to his agreement not to bar the special prosecutor from going to court, but could tell Jaworski what to do once he was in court. This new wrinkle was reflected in words today from federal judge John Sirica. In a court decision, he accused the president of attempting to abridge the special prosecutor's independence and asked what happened to the president's promise to get a consensus of congressional leaders before limiting the special prosecutor. Jaworski's letter to the Senate Judiciary Committee may reflect his concern that the case is moving out of court control. Last fall, in a similar case, the president said he would abide by a definitive decision of the highest court. But this time, the White House has refrained from saying the president will comply with any court decision. Carl Stern, NBC News, Washington.
The chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee is Eastland of Mississippi, and Senate sources say that Eastland has scheduled a meeting of the committee for tomorrow afternoon to discuss the Jaworski letter. There's been no comment from the White House. Judge Sirica today ordered President Nixon to hand over tapes and documents of 64 conversations subpoenaed by Jaworski. Jaworski had said he needed them for the trial in September of seven men charged in the Watergate cover-up, but President Nixon had asked Sirica to quash the subpoena. Today, Sirica told Mr. Nixon to deliver the tapes and documents by May 31st, but he gave the president until this Friday to appeal. The White House said there would be an appeal. Sirica rejected the president's legal argument in emphatic terms. He called it a nullity. The chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Peter Rodino, said today that that committee may subpoena tapes it has requested from the White House on the ITT and milk price cases. Rodino added that committee action will depend on a White House answer to a request for those materials. President Nixon's attitude to subpoenas brought something like a cry of despair today from a Republican member of the House Judiciary Committee.
I think the president seriously undermines some of the positions of some of his party members that want to give him the benefit of every single doubt, but then are almost in a state of frustration and anguish because he's refused to comply with a subpoena that had almost the full unanimous support of the Judiciary Committee. There was one dissenting vote on the last subpoena, so I hope he does comply with that subpoena.
In one of the trials arising out of Watergate, John Ehrlichman, Charles Colson, and four others are charged with conspiring to violate the civil rights of Daniel Ellsberg through the burglary of his psychiatrist's office. Today, Ehrlichman told the judge hearing motions in the case that it should be dismissed because he cannot get a fair trial. President Nixon's release of transcripts, Ehrlichman said, further amplified the inflammatory atmosphere. President Nixon wrote the judge supporting the defendant's argument that they were acting on the presidential authority to stop leaks. Mr. Nixon did not say he specifically authorized the Ellsberg break-in. Another federal judge in Washington today refused to dismiss charges against Lieutenant Governor Ed Reinecke of California or to move his trial to California. Reinecke is accused of lying to a Senate committee about ITT and the 1972 Republican convention. In other news tonight, a widespread manhunt is on for Patricia Hearst as a criminal involved with her terrorist kidnappers. NBC News correspondent David Barrington reports from Israel tonight that a Syrian-Israeli troop withdrawal agreement could be signed in Geneva as early as Sunday. And tonight we'll show you a college that gives degrees to students for working with their hands as well as with their minds. That and more news after this.
NBC Nightly News is brought to you by Exxon.
Low-polluting industrial fuel oil has been in short supply. This shortage has forced some industries and utilities to temporarily burn higher sulfur fuel. Down in the Caribbean, Exxon is working to meet America's need for more of the cleaner burning fuel oil. To help relieve the shortage, Exxon's Aruba refinery recently boosted its capacity to produce low sulfur fuel oil by 2 million gallons a day. To help the environment, Exxon is continuing to remove most of the pollution-causing sulfur from this oil. The sulfur we take out goes one way to be used by chemical plants, while as much of this cleaner-burning fuel oil as we can produce continues to go the other way, to American factories, utilities, and institutions.
Patricia Hearst, who was kidnapped 3.5 months ago by a group of terrorists calling themselves the Symbionese Liberation Army, now is being hunted down in California as a criminal. Here's a report from Jack Perkins in Los Angeles.
No longer wanted as a material witness, Patty Hearst is now listed by the FBI as a fugitive, armed and dangerous. She is believed still in or around Los Angeles. Police, for the last couple of days, have been moving from stakeout to stakeout, following one lead, then another, trying to find her and the few other SLA members who remain. One lead, last night, a young white woman and two black men went to this apartment building in Los Angeles, went upstairs to find the manager and demand an apartment. The young woman, the manager now believes, was Patty Hearst.
I wanted an apartment for this night, and say I don't have it, lady.
Answer the phone,
I give you $500 and say, if you give me $1,000, I don't have it. I said, well, I tell you something, you want to die? There's a time when she have the gun like that.
She pointed the gun at you.
And said, well, you want to kill me? Okay, kill me, but I don't have it apartment.
The FBI reports that Patty Hearst was involved in the shootout at a sporting goods store in Los Angeles last Thursday and the kidnapping of a young man.
We're trying to find her, and if we find her, well, we will arrest her. She is a federal fugitive. As in any federal fugitive, she will be given every opportunity to surrender herself, the same procedure that is used in any case, and we will follow the same policy. If we're fired upon, naturally, we're going to return.
That's right.
Up in Hillsborough, California, hearing their daughter described no longer as a witness but as a criminal now, the Hearsts had this to say.
I just hope everybody will remember that physically Patty is still a kidnap victim. She was taken away against her will. And psychologically, she's a victim of thought control by terrorists. I hope she'll give herself up and come home.
Well, I hope she'll give herself up too. But at this point in time, I don't believe that she's going to give herself up just to come home. If she believes what she says, or even 90% of what she says, or if she believes in the causes she says she does, she's much better off and much more important to that cause free than she is killed or being put in jail for a number of years. So far, she hasn't done anything, really.
Two of the remaining fugitive members of the Symbionese Liberation Army are William Harris and his wife, Emily. Mrs. Harris is the daughter of a suburban Chicago engineer, Frederick Schwartz. Today, Schwartz flew to Los Angeles to see what he could do to make the couple give up. And at the airport in Chicago, he pleaded with his daughter and son-in-law to turn themselves in.
You have only two choices open now. You may elect to die an equally horrible death and a totally useless one, with the probability of also taking the lives of innocent people. Your other choice is to come forth and live. With your God-given talents, and they are many, much can still be accomplished. Mom, Fred, Terry, and Bob, join me in the prayer and hope that we'll be arm in arm in safety in a few hours.
To earn a merit badge in atomic energy, today's scout has to learn about everything from Einstein to isotopes. This troop is about to see how Exxon Nuclear Company makes the fuel for a nuclear reactor. The fuel is these tiny pellets of enriched uranium. They started out as uranium ore at an Exxon mine in Wyoming. After being shaped, each pellet is inspected for precise uniformity. Then they're inserted into these tubes. The tubes are grouped together to form a fuel bundle. Finally, hundreds of these long bundles are sent to power plants, where they make up part of the core of a nuclear reactor. Today, atomic energy only supplies 5% of America's electrical power. 10 years from now, it should supply over 30%. When we reach that goal, these boys will be young men. Young men living in a much more self-sufficient, energy-producing nation.
Secretary of State Kissinger today reported good progress toward a Syrian-Israeli troop withdrawal. Later, various sources, Israeli and American, reported that an agreement is imminent. NBC News correspondent David Barrington, quoting high Israeli military sources, said an agreement could be signed in Geneva as early as Sunday and probably no later than Tuesday. Barrington's sources said the main sticking point is still the width of the buffer zone to be occupied by United Nations peacekeeping forces. Israel has agreed to give up the part of Syria taken in the 1973 war and the city of Quneitra in the Golan Heights. Further, Israel is prepared to pull back 2 to 7 kilometers elsewhere in the Golan Heights, but no more. Finally, Israel, with the tacit agreement of Kissinger, will regard the new line as the final line, meaning that Israel will not give up all of the Golan Heights, which were taken in the 1967 war. Yesterday, Israel continued its reprisals against Lebanon for harboring Arab terrorists, this time with a gunboat raid on a Palestinian camp south of the port of Tyre.
12,000 people live here in the Rashidiya refugee camp along the Mediterranean, 9 miles north of the Israeli border. Late Sunday afternoon, 4 Israeli gunboats, protected by a screen of fighter planes, shelled the camp for almost an hour. The Lebanese army returned the fire and said it hit one of them. An Israeli radio broadcast heard in Beirut said the attack was aimed at Palestinian guerrilla command posts near the shore at the edge of the camp. A number of the concrete block buildings near the water were hit, but some of the shells fell inland into the center of the residential area. A man and his teenage son were killed when 2 shells crashed through the wall of their home. 3 other refugees died in the attack. One of the Palestinian leaders in the camp said more people would have been killed had not the village been partially evacuated several hours before the shelling began. Those who left, mostly women and children, began returning early in the morning. They found that the explosions had knocked out the camp's water supply, power, and telephone lines, leaving the thousands of refugees without electricity, communications, or drinking water. This has been the most violent week in the Middle East since the October War. More than 80 people, many of them women and children, have been killed on both sides of the border, and there are no indications that the end is in sight. John Palmer, NBC News, at the Rashidiya refugee camp in southern Lebanon.
In Northern Ireland today, supplies of food began to run low, and that brought out long lines of people at food stores. That was one effect of a general strike called by Protestants who do not want Roman Catholics to have an effective voice in the new Northern Ireland government. George Montgomery has a report.
Barricades made of hijacked vehicles were widespread in Protestant areas of Northern Ireland as the 6-day-old strike reached crisis point. The barricades sealed off Protestant neighborhoods and kept thousands of people from going to work. Reports spoke of many who wanted to work, but were intimidated out of doing so by the barricade gangs. Factories and other businesses were closed by the Protestant loyalist walkout aimed at stopping British political moves seen by the militants as selling them out into a united Ireland with the Catholic Irish Republic. The province was virtually crippled. Electricity supplies were hard hit. Food was running low in some areas. The strike hit downtown Belfast hard. The area was almost as quiet as on a Sunday. Offices and stores were closed because employees couldn't get in. The buses were on strike. Only the soldiers were busy, searching the few people around and patrolling the abnormally quiet area. People spoke of possible violence to come and the intimidation. The docks were shut down, as were the shipyards. They are the bedrock of Belfast's economy. In the Protestant slums of Belfast, hardline paramilitary men say they are tired of being pushed around by the British government, which they accuse of favoring the Roman Catholic minority. They complain about living conditions. Protestant militants say the Catholics have the same need for new housing as themselves, but they add that there is an important difference. The Catholics, they say, want their new housing to be in a united Ireland, while the Protestants want theirs to be, as now, in Britain. This difference over a united Ireland goes on dividing the two poverty-stricken groups. The British government is caught in the middle, with the threat of violence strongly present. George Montgomery, NBC News, Belfast.
Tonight, Britain flew 500 more soldiers to Northern Ireland to join the 16,000 already there.
Long before today's energy shortage, Exxon began digging for energy down in this huge Wyoming pit. It wasn't for oil or natural gas, but for uranium. We're mining thousands of tons of uranium ore a day to help run nuclear power plants, which will be supplying more and more of our nation's energy. Today, the mine is functional and not very pretty. But after the uranium ore has been extracted and we leave, things will be a lot different. You see, the day we took the first ore out of this pit, we started reclaiming the land. The earth that was removed was spread over the adjacent hills, contoured, then seeded and planted to match the Wyoming landscape. And in a few years, when we're through, this mine will be filled in and landscaped too. So once again, this area will become just the wide open spaces of Wyoming.
The final returns are in from yesterday's French presidential election. Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, the conservative candidate, won by less than 2% of the vote over François Mitterrand, the socialist running with communist support. Giscard's small majority is only one of a number of problems that he faces. Lloyd Dobbins reports.
Demonstrating on the Champs-Élysées is a traditional French way to celebrate a presidential election victory, and Valéry Giscard d'Estaing had been elected. The fact that he won by the narrowest margin in recent French history did not dampen the street celebration, and conversely, the street celebration did not diminish the problems Giscard now faces. The next people who take to the streets could be France's union members. During the campaign, the union stayed quiet to help the socialist candidate, but he lost, and there is no reason now for the unions to hold back. Two major union leaders have already said that if Giscard does not provide higher wages and benefits, the unions will force him to. One problem Giscard does not have is with business. His election caused the value of the French franc and stocks in French companies to go up slightly when the markets opened in Paris. Money that had gone out of France when the socialists promised, if elected, to nationalize some industry is now coming back in. To win votes, Giscard promised to make social changes, to improve people's lives. But one of his better-known supporters has now said perhaps Giscard had promised more than the economy would let him deliver. But he will have to do something to reunite the French. They are now deeply and almost evenly divided, and as one Paris newspaper said, France cannot be governed against half the French. Giscard, a 48-year-old economic specialist, will officially take office next Monday. He's expected to try to get a broad political representation in his cabinet. If he can, that would underline his campaign promise to be the president of all the French. That will be a difficult and tricky political undertaking. He must move further to the left than the Gaullists and not as far as the Socialists. He cannot afford to anger his own supporters, but he must at least try to please his opponents. He must do that while working with a National Assembly that is still principally Gaullist.
Giscard's term is for 7 years, but he will have only a few months in which to begin his programs. In general, the French do not like change, but when they decide they want it, then they do not like to wait for it. So Giscard takes office with difficult social and economic problems to solve, with a strong left looking over his shoulder and waiting for him to make a mistake, and with his own supporters impatient for him to act. Lloyd Dobbins, NBC News, Paris.
Secretary General Waldheim of the United Nations today expressed serious concern over India's explosion on Saturday of its first nuclear device. David Brinkley's journal tonight is about that explosion. David?
Now there are 6 countries in the world with nuclear explosives. It could turn out, in the perspective of history, to be 6 too many. India set off an underground explosion over the weekend and became the 6th, and by far the poorest, member of this club. There is great pride and exuberance among the people and the politicians, but something less than that in other countries in that part of the world. In Japan, for example, survivors of the American bomb in Hiroshima had a sit-down strike and said they were astonished that India, after all of its pious lectures to the world on nonviolence, had built the most violent weapon of all. India's leaders said it was only for peaceful purposes. But they must have said that when they invented the bow and arrow. The other questions were about the wisdom of a country spending $170-odd million for a nuclear explosion when 80% of its population is hungry and the population growing faster than the food. But governments generally believe that people expect them to do something, and if they are unable to do what needs to be done, then they will expend talent, energy, and money doing what does not need to be done. While India's case is extreme and certainly a waste they can't afford, the wasting of money on needless projects simply because they know how to do it is not unknown in this country. Ed?
It is now the fashion in some political circles to reveal your income tax return. Senator Edward Kennedy today made it known that he and his wife had a gross income last year of $452,000. And they paid tax of $218,000, which is 48%.
These men are doing something about the energy shortage. And so is the company they work for. They're oil men, and their job takes them 30 miles out into the Gulf of Mexico. As important as their work is, it's only a small part of Exxon's effort to supply more energy. Exxon has initiated the largest development program in its history. Over the next 4 years, Exxon plans to spend $16 billion. Most of this money will be spent to find, develop, and transport oil and gas in the U.S. and around the world. $16 billion is a huge investment for a single company. But considering America's energy needs, it's a necessary one.
President Nixon said today that doctor bills in this country may go up by as much as 22% this year. The president said that in a radio speech in which he said that health costs in general are skyrocketing, and in which he asked Congress to pass his national health insurance plan quickly. The Senate today authorized $24 billion in aid to education over the next 4 years. Half the money would go to students from poor families. The bill now goes to a House-Senate conference. President Nixon has already vetoed one education bill and has threatened to veto this one in its present form. There was a time when a college degree in liberal arts assured a person of a good job, but no more. Today, a lot of history and philosophy majors are driving taxicabs. So now many people are going to college to learn to use their hands instead of their heads. Lou Davis reports.
Parker Littlefield has a bachelor's degree in marketing from New York University. Yet he's working on the assembly line in an auto plant. He said he took this job because it was steady, and now he's making more money than he's ever made before. Michael Barchese graduated from the University of New Mexico, then took 2 years of graduate work at Syracuse University, majoring in journalism. He spent 9 years in the Navy, 3 years in the Peace Corps, but he's now working here because he can't find steady work reporting, and he has a mother to support. Littlefield and Barchese are two of the many thousands of people in the United States who have found that college educations are nice, but when it comes to finding jobs, what the country needs right now is men who can work with their hands. According to a recent Labor Department survey, in the next decade, 3 out of 4 jobs won't require college degrees, but will require some kind of formal training. For that reason, Ferris State College deals heavily in vocational education, training for the nuts and bolts jobs, the kinds of jobs that are becoming increasingly more complex. Ferris has 9,000 enrolled students this year, and most of them are in some kind of a job training program. College president Dr. Robert Uigleben likes to call Ferris an opportunity school.
We're primarily trying to prepare people to go to work. We're trying to give them the skills that they can use for entry into primarily technical occupations, and then we're trying to hook some liberal arts onto them so that they can be successful in the other dimensions of their life after they've gotten that first job.
Hey, you have a lot of resistance in that thing. Huh? Put it on the next scale, Craig.
One of the most popular courses at the school is automotive technology. After 4 years, the students earn a Bachelor of Science degree. School officials say they have calls from all over the country for trained mechanics, and they can't begin to fill the demand. College officials say that 97% of the students who graduated last year found jobs, 90% in fields related to their course of study. Ferris also has a special program in aviation electronics. It's the only college laboratory in the country that is licensed by the Federal Aviation Administration to do repairs. Ferris is also offering courses in construction technology. A large number of students come here after graduating from other colleges because they found that after graduating, they couldn't find work.
One of the disadvantages of a 4-year Bachelor of Arts degree in my majors, political science and history, is that they're not particularly marketable. So I was more or less forced to take some inconsequential jobs, even menial jobs, such as working in a fruit market as a stock boy, or working in a liquor store as a cash register ringer, things of that effect.
There are many educators who are upset about what's happening here at Ferris State College. They say that a college education should be an intellectual awakening and not just job training. But Ferris officials point out that if a student is interested in philosophy or poetry, those courses are available here. And at the same time, a student can also pick up a marketable job skill. Lou Davis, NBC News, Big Rapids, Michigan.
That's the news. I'm Edwin Newman. Good night for NBC News.